Greetings, this is Jeff Riddle, pastor of Christ Reformed Baptist Church in Louisa, Virginia, and this is another in this series of readings from and notes and commentary upon Augustine of Hippo's Harmony of the Evangelists. We're resuming this series after about a one-year break. I think the last one I recorded was in March of 2022, and now it's March of 2023. We are beginning book two of Augustine's Harmony of the Evangelists. There are four books in the entire work. This second book is the longest in the series. It consists of some 80 chapters, and it covers the events recorded in the Gospel of Matthew with comparison to the other three Gospels up to the Last Supper. And so for today, we're going to look at the prologue, and then we're going to look at book 2 and chapter 1, and then book 2 and chapter 2. So here's the heading overall for this second book. It says, in this book, Augustine undertakes an orderly examination of the gospel according to Matthew, on to the narrative of the supper, and institutes a comparison between it and the other gospels by Mark, Luke, and John, with the view of demonstrating a complete harmony between the four evangelists throughout all these sections. We begin with the prologue to the second book, wherein Augustine writes, whereas, in a discourse of no small length and of imperative importance, which we have finished with the compass of one book, we have refuted the folly of those who think that the disciples who have given us these gospel histories deserve only to be disparagingly handled, for the express reason that no writings are produced by us with the claim of being compositions which have proceeded immediately from the hand of that Christ whom they refuse indeed to worship as God, but whom, nevertheless, they do not hesitate to pronounce worthy to be honored as a man of surpassing all other men in wisdom. And as further, we have confuted those who strive to make him out to have written in a strain suiting their perverted inclinations, but not in terms calculated by their perusal and acceptance to set men right or to turn them from their perverse ways. Let us now look into the accounts which the four evangelists have given us of Christ, with the view of seeing how self-consistent they are and how truly in harmony with each other. And let us do so in the hope that no offense, even of the smallest order, may be felt in this line of things in the Christian faith by those who exhibit more curiosity than capacity, insofar as they think that a study of the evangelical books conducted not in the way of a merely cursory perusal, but in the form of a more ordinarily careful investigation, has disclosed to them certain matters of an inopposite and contradictory nature, and insofar as their notion is that these things are to be held up as objections in the spirit of contention rather than pondered in the spirit of consideration. Here ends the prologue. We move on to book 2 and chapter 1. The heading of this chapter is a statement of the reason why the enumeration of the ancestors of Christ is carried down to Joseph, while Christ was not born of that man's seed, but of the Virgin Mary. Augustine writes, Book 2, Chapter 1. The evangelist Matthew has commenced his narrative in these terms: the book of the generation of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. And that's a reference to Matthew 1:1. By this exordium, he shows with sufficient clearness that his understanding is to give an account of the generation of Christ according to the flesh. For, according to this, Christ is the Son of Man, a title which he also gives very frequently to himself, thereby commending to our notice that what in his compassion he had condescended to be on our behalf. For that heavenly and eternal generation, in virtue of which he is the only begotten Son of God, before every creature, because all things were made by him, is so ineffable that it is of it that the word of the prophet must be understood when he says, who shall declare his generation? And that's a quotation from Isaiah 53 and verse 8. Matthew, therefore, traces out the human generation of Christ, mentioning his ancestors from Abraham downwards, and carrying them on to Joseph, the husband of Mary, of whom Jesus was born. For it was held allowable to consider him dissociated from the married estate which was entered into with Mary, on the ground that she gave birth to Christ, not as the wedded wife of Joseph, but as a virgin. For by this example an illustrious recommendation is made to faithful married persons of the principle, that even when by common consent they maintain their continence, the relation can still remain and can still be called one of wedlock, inasmuch as, although there is no connection between the sexes of the body, there is the keeping of the affections of the mind, particularly so for this reason, that in their case we see how the birth of a son was a possibility apart from anything of that carnal intercourse which is to be practiced with the purpose of the procreation of children only. Moreover, the mere fact that he had not begotten him by act of his own was no sufficient reason why Joseph should not be called the father of Christ, for indeed he could be in all propriety the father of one whom he had not begotten by his own wife, but had adopted from some other person. Christ, it is true, was also supposed to be the son of Joseph in another way, as if he had been born simply of that man's seed. But this supposition was entertained by persons whose notice the virginity of Mary escaped. For Luke says, "And Jesus himself began to be about 30 years of age, being, as was supposed, the son of Joseph." And that's a citation from Luke 3:23. This Luke, however, instead of naming Mary, his only parent, had not the slightest hesitation in also speaking of both parties as his parents, when he says, "And the boy grew and waxed strong, filled with wisdom, and the grace of God was in him, and his parents went to Jerusalem every year at the feast of the Passover." But, lest any one may fancy that by the parents here are rather to be understood the blood relations of Mary, along with the mother herself, what shall be said to that preceding word of the same Luke, namely, "And his father and mother marveled at those things which are spoken of him"? Since then, he also makes the statement that Christ was born, not in consequence of Joseph's connection with the mother, but simply of Mary the Virgin. How can he call him his father, unless it be that we are to understand him to have been truly the husband of Mary, without the intercourse of the flesh, indeed, but in virtue of the real union of marriage, and thus also to have been in a much closer relation, the father of Christ, insofar as he was born of his wife, than would have been the case had he been only adopted from some other party? And this makes it clear that the clause, "as was supposed," is inserted with a view to those who are of opinion that he was begotten by Joseph in the same way as other men are begotten. Let's move on to Book 2 and Chapter 2, which has the heading, "An Explanation of the Sense in Which Christ is the Son of David, Although He Was Not Begotten in the Way of Ordinary Generation by Joseph, the Son of David." Thus too, even if one were able to demonstrate that no descent, according to the laws of blood, could be claimed from David for Mary, we should not warrant enough to hold Christ to be the son of David, on the ground of that same mode of reckoning by which also Joseph is called his father. But seeing that the Apostle Paul unmistakably tells us that Christ was of the seed of David according to the flesh, in Romans 1:3, how much more ought we to accept without hesitation the position that Mary herself also was descended in some way according to the laws of blood from the lineage of David? Moreover, since this woman's connection with the priestly family also is a matter not left in absolute obscurity, inasmuch as Luke inserts the statement that Elizabeth, whom he records to be of the daughters of Aaron, was her cousin, we ought most firmly to hold by the fact that the flesh of Christ sprang from both lines, to wit, from the line of the kings and from that of the priests, in the case of which persons there was also instituted a certain mystical unction which was symbolically expressive among this people of the Hebrews. In other words, there was a chrism, which term makes the import of the name Christ patent, and presents it as something indicated so long time ago by an intimation so very intelligible. Here ends Book 2 and Chapter 2, and now we'll move on, having read Book 2, Chapters 1 and 2, to some notes. And we'll start off with the prologue. In the prologue, Augustine begins by noting that he intends to look into the four accounts of Christ in the Gospels and show that they are consistent with one another. In Book 2, Chapter 1, this book in Chapter 1 begins with an analysis of the genealogy of the Lord Jesus. Of course, that's the way the Gospel of Matthew begins. Augustine notes that by giving this genealogy, it's showing Christ as the Son of Man. He sees that term as relating to Christ's true humanity. He notes that he's also known as the Son of God, and this reflects the heavenly and eternal generation of Christ as the only begotten Son of God. But again, his human generation is going to be traced in the genealogy from Abraham to Joseph, the husband of Mary, as the Gospel of Matthew begins. Augustine notes that Joseph and Mary were married, though she was a virgin. They were, he says, an illustrious recommendation to husbands and wives that they may share affections of the mind with no connection between the sexes of the body. Augustine thus promotes his view that carnal intercourse is to be practiced with the purpose of procreation of children only. Joseph was not the father of Jesus biologically, but Joseph had adopted him from another. Augustine notes the statement from Luke 3:23 that Christ began his public ministry at about 30 years of age, being, as was supposed, the son of Joseph. Joseph could be called the father of Jesus only if he was truly the husband of Mary, without the intercourse of the flesh, indeed, but in virtue of the real union of marriage. Moving on now to Book 2 and Chapter 2, here he begins by explaining that even if Mary did not descend from David by blood, we could say that Christ descended from David by virtue of his adoption by Joseph. Given, however, that the Apostle Paul said in Romans 1:3 that Christ was of the seed of David according to the flesh, we know that Mary also descended directly from David. Given her connection to Elizabeth, she also came from the priestly line. So Christ came from the line of the kings, and he also came from the line of the priests. So this ends then, this little summary of Book 2, Chapters 1 and 2. And again, the emphasis here initially, as one might expect, if we're flowing the Gospel of Matthew, is going to be on the genealogy with which the Gospel of Matthew begins. And also, it begins with a stress on the virgin birth, the virginal conception, we might say, of Jesus, that he was born of Mary when she was a virgin, and that Mary was betrothed to Joseph, and they would share a marriage. And so Jesus would be the son of David in that sort of legal sense, while he would only be the biological son of the Virgin Mary. Well, we're going to bring this episode to a conclusion. I hope this has been helpful and edifying. And we're just getting started with Book 2, and we have some 78 chapters still to go to complete Book 2. We'll look forward to speaking to you in the next episode. Till then, take care and God bless.